Mark, O mighty one, our sacrifice begins. We commence.
Welcome to Spellbird, a podcast about the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. It's time to party like it's 1974.
We are so behind in our emails that our mailbag is overflowing. We have nearly 30 emails dating back more than 7 months, so we're going to dive right in. I'm Judge Jeff, and tonight we've got Judge Jen.
Greetings.
And Judge Julian.
Salutations.
Yes. Okay, I was going to skip tavern talk so we could go right into the summon email, but Jen rightfully pointed out we just came back from Gen Con. We should at least acknowledge a little bit of our Gen Con adventures, but we're going to keep things really nice and tight as we quickly go through tavern talk.
Welcome, friends. Good to see you.
I only had one drink to calm my nerves.
Innkeeper, a drink of your most expensive.
Tavern talk.
So here we are in tavern talk. And today I am going to be the taskmaster, and I'm keeping us all on a strict schedule. So Jen, Julian, we each have 2 minutes, and I'm timing this to talk about our Gen Con adventures. Julian, go.
So the cab ride in from the airport was really the hotel fiasco the day before. No, okay. So had a great time. We had an awesome time. Gen Con was a blast. Bought the Hobonomicon. All this good stuff happened. It was terrific. Got to see all these old friends. You do all the stuff that you like to do. But you guys know what we have to talk about. There was a certain playtest that happened on Wednesday night where Team the Floggy Bottom Boys and the other team. So Jen, Jeff, and I were privileged to take part in a last minute sort of tournament playtest to make, you know, kick the tires of the tournament. And we did, it's very top secret under, you know, we were all in locked up in the cone of silence. I just want to say Jeff was at table one, Jen and Julian were at table two.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, let's just say, a clear winner.
And who was the first one to die?
Oh,
who
yes.
rang the gong
who
first?
Who rang the gong first?
That may have been Judge Jeff.
Okay.
And it was glorious.
So I just want to finish this out by saying low ratings Jeff Goad was the first to ring the gong.
Oh.
Sad.
Oh.
You should brush up on your tournament chops.
Fake news. Fake news.
Fake news. All right, I'm done. Thanks. I had a blast. Thank you to everybody who was there. We had a blast. Thank you. Pass the mic.
Okay, Jen.
Okay, we got there early enough to help set up the booth on Tuesday and Wednesday, which was lovely and sweaty. Got to meet some people for the first time, which was amazing. Fellow editor Keith Garrett, Simone, who is from Brazil. She runs DCC down there. That was awesome. And also our layout guy for some of the new projects, Matt Hildebrandt, got a wonderful, wonderful package of rum from Keith Nelson. God bless you. Giogo delivered the package of the Brazilian Kickstarter DCC stuff that had that awesome engraved box. And the Dark Master was a little upset that there wasn't one for him. And so these are all very cool things. I got to sit on my very first seminar of Gen Con. I was on the panel. It was very bizarre. I had 30 seconds notice. Credit for that panic attack goes to, of course, Harley Stroh and Brendan LaSalle, as they dragged me up to be part of what they mentioned here on the show before, the DCC College, helping Ooh. New judges run DCC. The best new convert of the year was James Carella, who came back the next day, told me how the scratch-off game in his room went. And before he left the Goodman Games booth the second time, I had him approved into the Facebook group. And some other really cool news is that Emily, winner of the tournament last year, she's considering running DCC, and her first game may actually be at Brinkmanomicon, the second annual.
Ooh.
And then we came home and we got two beautiful black kitties that we named Harlan and Vance. And much like his namesake, Vance has no respect for women. Timed that good.
Timed that good. Okay.
Nice.
Perfect. So my 2 minutes start now. And I guess I'll start by saying I had a lot of fun getting there early and helping to set up the booth. I had some good quality time with our buddy Taco John. I also got to teach Harley Stroh and Brennan LaSalle how to translate phrases from gay into straight. For example, I said to them, if I were to say to you the following sentence, how would you translate this into heterosexual? And I said, girl, you are serving executive realness right now. So I had a lot of fun watching them try to figure out what that means. And then in terms of actually running and playing games, I got to run 3 sessions of the DCC tournament. And all 3 sessions of mine were TPKs.
Nice.
And I also got to run a 5th level MCC adventure, Apocalypse Arc, by Brendan LaSalle.
Oh, yeah.
Which was also a TPK.
Ouch.
So I slaughtered every single one of the players who dared to sit down at my table during this particular convention. My favorite moment from the tournament, though, is 4 of the 6 characters in one of the sessions all died in a doorway between the 1st and 2nd room killed 4 of them.
Nice.
That's a thing of beauty.
Question. Question.
Yes.
Did your tournament TPK streak sort of come out of your being the first guy to ring the gong and on the playtest night? Or the, you know, is it, you know?
Nice.
Are you insinuating that perhaps I was overcompensating from my loss on Wednesday night?
Just wondering. Just like to bring that up a lot. We'll probably talk about it more.
That's fair. And my time is up. So we are now heading on over to the meat of our episode, Summon Email.
I call upon the flame to summon you.
Who'll deliver the message for me?
I came here to give you these facts.
Summon Email.
Here we are in Summon Email. We have a tendency to get pretty verbose with our email responses, which is great and all, but in an effort to try to get caught up, we're going to be timing our responses.
Ooh.
Each person is going to read an email, and when the email is done being read, we will each have 1 minute to respond, and I'm timing it.
Oh, good Lord.
So, Julian, oh, and also I'm going to say, any of these emails that are quite long, I have edited them down quite a bit. My apologies to the people who sent us these emails, like the very next one by Judge Ken. I edited yours down quite a bit for the sake of time. But Julian, go ahead and hit us with that first email.
All right, here we go. Judge Ken. Hi, judges. When I heard the intro to this week's show, I was worried about the show. After hearing the discussion, I was really happy with how you handled it. I have some quibbles. I do want to say the golden rule on my table is assume positive intent. So I'm going to try that with my feedback post. I will say that by having a more diverse family life, it has changed my straight white male views on diversity and the importance of having visuals or covers and things. I also have 2 young daughters that play role-playing games, and I think that having over-sexualized covers and content, which DCC does have, makes it very hard for me to introduce them to the game. I think the language of how people want to promote RPGs and specifically OSR gaming needs to change. It shouldn't be about we need to be more diverse for diversity's sake. I think it should be more about we need more customers so we can have more people to play with and more products to play with. As the market grows, it only means more games and more tables to play at. I know I'm rambling, but this topic is so dense that it's hard to keep it to a few sentences. I think we need to sell trying to have more people playing from different backgrounds as about getting more customers so we can have more cool things to play and more cool people to play with. I was really surprised about how well you handled the show. I'm sure you guys were nervous about it because it has sadly become a contentious topic. Thanks, Judes. I think he meant judges. Sometimes people call me Jude, so maybe he was only meaning me. I don't know. But thanks, judges. From Judge Ken. That's an extremely pared down version, Ken. All I can say is I think I agree with everything Ken said. And actually, he had a lot of cool stuff in his email, but he made a lot of great points. And diversity is about, you know, everybody and about growing the base and having more gamers. Couldn't agree more. That's it for me.
Fantastic. How about you, Jen?
I don't know that I really need to add on to this. It's kind of an opinion piece, right? I mean, we're all 100% behind this, so.
Perfect. I would also second that. So I think it's we're ready to go on to our next email. So Jen, go ahead and hit us with this one.
This one, I may not have much to add to it. This comes to us from Chantel, who I believe wrote to us before. Hi, Jen and guys. I love that. I just wanted to say that for the most part, I really enjoyed the show. I would like to say one thing, and I know not all women or other people feel the same way I do. In the show, it was brought up that we want women to feel safe, so we should not have covers of orc women with huge boobs. I really like those covers. Also, the covers can be safe, no boobs, and still make people feel unsafe. I give you Judge's Guild, the glory hole, Dwarven Mine. Now, I know in the context of the game, they're talking about a place where there's a huge gold vein, but any man worth his weight in gold is going to know what else the glory hole is, and I can understand a woman not wanting to play in an adventure where there could be jokes about grabbing them by the, shall we say, ... Thanks, Chantel. You know, I'm... Yep, what she said. How's that for brevity?
Chantel, thank you. That was a fun email, a smart email, and also you fulfilled my podcasting career goal of talking about Glory Hole Dwarven Mine on a podcast. It's strange it took me this long, actually, but well said and good email.
Yeah, it is true. When I go through and I show people really fun, kind of goofy old products, I do love to pull out my copy of Glory Hole Dwarven Mine just so people can kind of crack up at it. But yeah, great email. Thank you, Chantel. So I'm going to go ahead and move on over to our next email. And this one is from Aaron. He says, hello, thank you for the email address from our Twitter conversation. I know your mailbag is full, but here is the adventure created by Studio 9 Games, approved for publication by Goodman Games. We're supposed to review this, aren't we?
Yeah.
It has a few more rounds of refined editing, but it is ready for the most part for review. Please let us know if you are able to add this to your reviews, and we will share it with our fans. From Aaron. Okay, so I'm guessing we haven't read this to review this yet, have we?
No. So, mea culpa. In fact, I think it's possible, Jeff, if I recall correctly, that you were supposed to do this. And no, I'm just kidding. We might have had a discussion about doing it and just completely forgot. I'm pretty sure that's what happened. The sad thing is he, had, of course, had to attach a copy, and I'm looking at it, and it looks really cool. The art is phenomenal.
What is the title?
Yeah, sorry. The title is Greenwood of the Fae Sovereign, which I have seen before.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's been out now for several months, and it's really cool looking. Has anybody played it or run it or anything like that?
I haven't.
I have it.
Well, there you go.
I haven't read it yet.
Oh, thank you for agreeing to review it on our next episode, Jen. That would be awesome. It looks pretty brief, actually. I don't think it, you know, it, one of us will review it. Let me put it that way. We owe you a review. We completely botched doing it for the Kickstarter, but we will at least go through and review it.
Perfect. So, Julian, this next email is you.
Very good. From John, Judge John Salyer.
Salyer.
Salyer. Oh, thank you. I saw your correction and I raised your... I just listened to episode 63. How dare you try to bring diversity into my white male power fantasies? Rawr! Seriously, though, great episode. Getting diversity into an organization is a long game. I think the first step is to do what we are doing, run games for everyone. Then if folks of color or LGBTQ enjoy it, hopefully they decide to sit behind the screen and run games or create content. I'm afraid it won't be an overnight change, but hopefully in my son's generation, gaming is seen as more inclusive. We are lucky here in Louisville to have some black folks and some gay, transgender folks in our local games. Yes, even in Kentucky. The work is being done. It will just take time. I want to say again that I'm thankful you are putting yourself out there as someone who is unafraid to share who you are and show people how wonderful and accepting RPGs can be. Thank you, Jeff. And there we go. Well said, John. I couldn't have said it better.
Well, John, I would like to apologize on behalf of Julian for both saying your name wrong and also pronouncing the name of the city that you live in incorrectly.
Louisville.
I was waiting.
Louisville.
I was waiting.
Louisville.
Louisville.
Louisville. So I'm sorry, buddy. You deserve better than that. Jen.
Louisville is kind of a Neapolitan city these days. So it makes sense. I'm actually a little bit jealous. I feel like I'm out here in the sticks these days as far as that kind of diversity goes. But we're getting there.
Nice. So, Jen, we've got a tweet here for you.
Yeah, it comes from @HeroSkulls. who at the time was going by This Quest Sucks. It's humorous to me. They say, I've been listening to the podcast Spellburn to get a better sense of DCC. How have you found the process of converting D&D 5e to DCC? And if I have to answer this first, I'm going to say I suck. I don't actually have any sort of those processes down. I would much rather just create it from whole cloth. Next.
All right. Julian.
I would agree. Well, first of all, I just haven't done it. I mean, I don't get it. Why would we take bad content and convert it to a game with much better content?
Now. What about the 5e conversions for Into the Borderlands? That would qualify at this point as something that we could in turn.
But that would be converting something that's already been converted into another conversion.
Oh, come on. Pretty much everything out there for 5e has been out there for something else already. It's been converted already to 5e.
And sometimes actually like wholly adapted, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like Castle Ravenloft and stuff.
Right.
Or Tomb of Annihilation.
It might sound like I'm just being flippant, which of course I am. However, I mean, I just haven't done that. I don't really have any experience doing it or anything like that. So that's all I can say.
Okay. And I guess I have a minute as well. I don't think I'm going to need to use the whole minute. But yeah, I would say I've also not found any 5e content that have been inspired to convert into DCC. If I were, for some reason, to convert it over, I would do it the way that I would do OSR materials that I'm inspired by. And that's just kind of, I just kind of wing it. You know, I take a look at the hit points and I take a look at the AC and I just kind of make it match what I think makes sense based on the games I've been playing and what works. And sometimes I won't even do it in advance. I just kind of figure it out on the fly. I'm like, okay, this thing looks tough. I'll give it an AC 17. Oh, this thing has, you know, 83 hit points because it's 5e. Maybe that's 30 hit points in DCC. There we go. And just kind of roll with it that way. I don't think about it too much.
So what I'm getting from this is get a little bit of experience running DCC and get a feel for the monsters, hit dice and everything, and how your play is going to go before you start worrying about conversions.
That sounds good. Okay, cool.
I like putting things in nutshells.
Yes, thank you, Jen. So our next email is from Judge Joan. And this is before she was a guest on the show. So this is old school. This is back in the day. She says, Judges, Jays, rock. Just listen to this past Spellburns episode. Thank you so much for all of your answers to my questions. And yes, with all the running of games, I came to the same conclusion you all gave. My players are all leveling up, and I'm in the process of listening to Spellburn from the beginning. Why? Well, having a better understanding of the game, I'm understanding some of the more details given in the early episodes. This game has been wonderful therapy for my emotional healing after a life career devastation, if that makes any sense. It got me involved with people when I just wanted to crawl into a cave and leave the world alone. I can't wait to see you all at GaryCon, and I'm so thankful for my new job and my boss who understands that I need to be a nerd and a geek. Blessings, Joan. Well, Joan, thank you so much. That's a very sweet email. And, you know, I think we can all kind of relate to the idea that that gaming serves a really important place in our life. On a social level, on a psychological level, like this is something that like I absolutely need to feel centered and sane and happy. It's a really important outlet for me. What do you guys say?
I chime in 100%. I don't know where I would be if I hadn't discovered this. Oh my God, 6 years ago.
Wow.
I realized about 2015 that God, even just that past 3 years had been so life changing on so many levels. And the one constant was the DCC community.
Yeah.
So yay for Big Fuzzy Gelatinous Cube.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. And I don't know if people who have had some tough times tend to gravitate to it. Maybe in certain ways we do. Whereas, you know, maybe people with boring lives approach it more in a board gamey way. I don't know. That's an interesting supposition that I have absolutely no data to back up. However, I still love it as much as I did when I was 14 or 13 or whatever. Actually, probably younger than that. And that's all I got to say.
Sounds great. So, Julian, it looks like we've got another email from Joan here.
Yes. Hello, Judges J. Would love to hear about use of animals in DCC. especially in zero level and first level adventures. My groups love to have name their animals and get them fully involved in the funnel or adventure. Page 87, Mounted Combat, speaks only of horses and warhorses. I have a player who wants to use as pony as a mounted steed. How would you adjudicate?
Ooh.
Let's go to the book. Page 87. I mean, the first thing I'm thinking is, you know, I'm going to sort of treat a pony as a 75% horse or probably a 50% war horse, you know?
That makes sense.
So I'm going to kind of reduce most of those stats in that kind of way. I'm scanning down page 87. Mounted, so yeah, so that's just about speed, and that's just about how they attack, which is, you know, they use the, it can also make an attack, so a pony could probably make an attack as a mount. Initiative is done for both horse and, yes, mounted character. I think most of these rules would apply. Mostly this is about how you interact with the mechanics when you're mounted, so I'm not sure that it really matters what you're mounted on. So to me, it looks like pretty much the same.
Yeah, yeah. You had to do research. It's all good.
Jen, do you have any thoughts?
You know, I'm inclined to go the same way. You know, you want to do something, it better make a deed, man. Make a deed out of it. Especially if it's not a trained horse. I mean, if it's a pony, how often has it actually been in combat before? Are you sure it's not going to run at the first clang of metal? So, yeah, give me a deed and we'll count that as like the handling in there as well. I'm all about simplifying it a little.
I think that's great. And for me, it's all about if we can make it make sense in the fiction, then I'm going to roll with it. You know, if your characters are wandering through the forest and they kind of stumble across a cottage and they find somebody's pony tied up, and then they just steal that pony they've never ridden before, have no relationship with, and now want to ride it into combat, that's not something I'm going to really see us turning to page 87 using the mounted combat rules for.
Nice.
If it's a pony who has been in a bunch of fights with your character and we have a history together and it's been a part of the story and you now want to use that pony in a way that's going to be beneficial to you in combat, then heck yeah. Like if it makes sense in the fiction of what we're doing together, I'm all in favor of saying yes to those things. I don't want to be the guy who's like obsessing over like, well, it says this in the rule book. If it makes sense, then yes. And if it doesn't, then it helped me understand what you're trying to accomplish here. And now the timer's going off on me. So
how's it feel?
Jen, you got this next one.
Next one comes to us from Andrew, a.k.a. Gladys Grumblebottom. Hey, everybody. I started listening to your wonderful podcast a few months ago and have caught up. Bravo. It's fantastic. I've been playing and judging DCC for many years now. I love it. Ran into an interesting combo with a few new players. One of my players has a level 2 dwarf and a level 1 halfling with 16 luck. He has figured out a gnarly combo. Dwarf rolls attack with Mighty Deed, D20 plus D4. The halfling then burns a point of luck to increase the deed die. The result is an increase to damage, chance to hit with primary and shield, and some mighty deed goes off. Does this seem off to you, or is the dwarf halfling duo just a killing machine? I've considered saying no halfling luck on deed die, but that feels dirty. What's your feelings? Thanks, Andrew, aka Gladys Grumblebottom. Okay, start the clock. We've been over this time and time again, both on the show and in the forums and in the G+ group and on Facebook. And the powers that be have essentially meted it out to say that, yes, you can spend luck on any roll, but the deed die is not a roll unto itself. That deed die goes with your attack die and with your damage die. So those are considered two different rolls. You can have the halfling spend luck on your attack roll. You can have the halfling spend luck on the damage roll. But it should never increase what the deed ends up doing. Like if you're looking at precision shot, that mighty deed on the chart, you're trying to bump from a 2 to a 4, that's not going to fly. Next!
I like it.
I don't know. That what Jen said is fairly reasonable and makes kind of good intellectual type sense and seems what people who are smart would do. So I'm against it.
I say it because I also had a player at the table who debated it for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know. I think in the heat of battle, I would probably just go with it. And while I think the rationale you give makes sense, Jen, and if people had a good discussion about it, I might fall down in that direction. But honestly, I don't see it way tipping the luck spending doesn't happen that much that the amount spent is going to tip the game that much. I mean, maybe one encounter, but the game is challenging enough that one encounter is generally not going to way overpower everything. I don't know.
Hey, if a halfling has 16 points of luck, chances are he's willing to spend down to 3. So that's 13, 26 points coming in on extra damage.
Yep.
Per attack. You're looking at 3 attacks from a dwarf, man.
Yeah.
Or 2, rather. You're looking at 2. Sorry, the shield bash and the attack. And that one die, trying to spend luck on that one die roll, just no.
Well, I'm going to move us along from this. I think you guys have given us a lot of great points on this. I don't really personally have anything else to add to this. So unless Julian, it seems like you're kind of itching to say one last thing, are you?
Well, I would just say that I've been running a ton of con games. And believe me, you were mathematically somewhat correct, Jen. But the people spending luck in my con games, they just can't game the system like that. So in a con game, I'm not afraid of it, you know?
Okay.
If it was me playing, yeah, I'd be messing the heck out of that.
Perfect. So Gladys, it seems like you've got a yes in a con game and a no in your campaign from the other judges. So the next email comes to us from Rob/WhaleSlake. Hi, guys. This email is in reply to the email in episode 65, in which itself was a reply to episode 63. Phew, I hope that makes sense. Basically, what I wanted to say was that although, yes, the hill you have to climb to be a successful creative is a steep bugger, that requires huge sacrifices from anyone who wants to get to the top, a published module, we have to recognize that due to factors such as prejudice, representation, income, education, etc., some people get to start closer to the top of the hill than others, and it is cool to be able to turn around and give them a help up. What a fucking hippie. Keep up the good work, band. Sincerely, Rob/WhaleSlake. Are we all in agreement with this, or do you guys have anything else that you want to add to that?
No, I like it.
Sounds like we're all good on that one. So thanks, Rob.
Yeah, thinking.
Julian, we've got another email here for us to go through.
All right. This one is from someone named DM Kojo.
Mm.
Kojo!
Never heard of him.
Hey, gang. As I write this, I am 1 week out from GaryCon, where I hope to game with the lot of you. I wanted to suggest an episode topic for the near future. What's new with Goodman Games? I know that this seminar is usually recorded and rebroadcast by Spellburn. I also know that this seminar is not happening at GaryCon this year, as the Dark Master will not be in attendance. So I was hoping that you could invoke the Dark Master to come on the show and let us know what he would have told us had he been at GaryCon. I can't wait until the release of the Gen Con What's New recording to find out what goodness he has in store for us. Thanks and burn on.
Hey, this one's actually almost timely.
Indeed.
Exactly. It may be five, 6 months old, but it actually is relevant to this moment.
Kojo, we're getting there. Stay tuned. Love you. Bye.
Yeah, I think we will actually probably, when you get this, we'll already have posted the What's New with Goodman Games from Gen Con, you know, or they'll drop around the same time. So it is coming quickly.
Nice.
Sure.
Quickly.
So, Jen, we have a lightly edited email coming up here for you.
Yeah, it's from someone named Jeff, but based on the topic, I'm guessing it's not Judge Jeff. So... Jeff says, hi, I just listened to your podcast about welcoming all and had a few thoughts that may help in framing views of the other side. First off, I'm a Mennonite Christian. Think Amish, but a bit less based on tradition and more on what we see in the Bible. I'm socially and theologically conservative, but not super far out there. I do use a computer. My main gaming group is pretty similar to me, white males between 25 and 45. We would not have any problems gaming with someone from an LGBTQ background, except that they're not available. Being a minority group really limits those around here. My county has less than 20,000 people. For us, diversity means socioeconomic status. I am in the upper 10% of wealth in my county simply because I'm not on government subsidies. My group often sets up games for local kids and finds that gaming with kids from generations of poverty is a very different experience. If a kid has been parented by meth addicts, they will respond to a treasure pile differently than the well-loved kids will. And yes, I'm saying that meth addicts love their kids less. I have seen horrors. Ooh, that's heavy. I think the rural and urban division makes any talk of diversity difficult. I would love to hear more conversations about how to game across social stratas. Personally, I believe that with role-playing games, we can help elevate the futures of some low-caste kids. If you ever go back to diversity, consider looking outside of race, gender, and orientation. While those are important and vital, they are only a small portion of the topic. Hope I didn't get too rambly there. Thanks for the show. I always like it when I get to listen. Thanks, Jeff. Well, Jeff, I don't know about my fellow judges, but I feel a little schooled here. And at least now, when I was a kid, I was totally in this spot where I didn't know where I fit in the socioeconomic strata. And yeah, the whole gaming thing was kind of beyond me on multiple levels. So I'm going to pass this off. Hey, Judge Jeff, take this one.
Okay, great. I would love to. So yes, Jeff, thank you for your email. I think you make a lot of great points. I will not speak to whether or not meth addicts love their children less, but I do think it is definitely clear that meth addicts are probably not giving their kids the same kind of attention and active loving parenting that a parent who is not actively addicted to drugs is giving them. And I think it's a really important point that you bring up, that introducing the games to kids who don't have the economic means to access these games is incredibly important. Not all kids have access to gaming stores, to computers with internet, or to a credit card to order a $30 book from a specialized gaming website. So anything we can do to bring games to all kids, regardless of their race, gender, socioeconomic background, whatever, I think is incredibly important. And my alarm is going off now. So, Julian, do you have anything you would like to add to
that? Yeah, that meth kids thing is a little much for me, but I think I get his general gist of his point, and I think you respond to that, Jeff. So thank you. You know, I will just say a me too to the idea that diversity is a big thing. And you can throw age in there, you could throw religion in there, you can throw many things besides, you know, gender and orientation and race and all that stuff. So this is a nice reminder that it's a little different milieu and, you know, socioeconomic and different religion and rural, urban and all that stuff. I mean, diversity is all these things. So thanks, Jeff, for writing in. That's a good reminder. And it's nice to hear from, you know, a different slice of life.
And I'll poke back in just to say this really highlights just how important it is for the people like DM Kojo running in schools and getting everybody into it, even from different ages.
Absolutely. Gaming clubs in public schools and in public libraries like Harley does. All that is very important.
Yes.
So I've got another email here from Rob Waleslake. Hello, judges. So after an enthusiastic chat over a cup of tea with one of my regular gaming partners, we both agreed we would like to play an RPG based on the Harryhausen-esque world of Jason and the Argonauts, Sinbad, Clash of the Titans, etc., especially with an emphasis on gods and patrons intervening at every inevitably inconvenient turn of the story. Enter DCC. I am still new to the system, and so have turned to you and your listeners' wisdom in asking for recommendations for any modules or supplements that would help in reskinning the traditional DCC setting to a world of sand, sandals, and stop motion. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Thanks, and keep up the good work, Rob/Waleslake. Okay, so I wish I had a chance to think about this more before answering. It's a great question and it's a great idea. I feel like it would be pretty easy to take most of the DCC modules and reskin them for something like this. You know, I think that you can really kind of put any of these modules, like if you want to put like Elzamon in the blood drinking box, you can throw that onto some random rocky aisle that your character's ship has to stop onto to pick up some part of their like grand odyssey quest that they're on. And that's what's at the bottom of that deep, deep pit in Elzamon and the blood drinking box, you know, or you can go ahead and throw in Neon Knights and maybe make the traveling from the interdimensional traveling, maybe we can make that a little less Heavy Metal Magazine and kind of a little more Harryhausen by having, my timer's going off.
You do this to yourself.
By having it be some dark genie magic or something. That's the end of my thought. Okay, who wants to go next?
Julian.
I will say I can't think of any strictly, you know, that type of adaptation for DCC, which is kind of weird. Maybe the much talked about but not yet published Pyramid Crawl Classics would go that way a little bit. I have no idea. Ooh. Jen can talk about that. But I think it wouldn't be that hard to do. If I was going to try to adapt that, actually I'm pretty well versed in the Greek, the ancient Greek literature and stuff like that. And if I were to do it, I think I would obviously know elves, dwarves, halflings, but I would probably really focus it on thieves and warriors. And, you know, I might allow one cleric or wizard in a party, but if you read those old stories, they're mostly about fighting men and occasionally women and magic items being the good guys. And, you know, it's very sword and sorcery, and that magic users types tend to be the bad guys. So that's what I would do.
Perfect. Jen.
Okay. Go watch Hundra. Talk about sandals and sorcery, man. Treasure Vaults of Zatabad is a third-party DCC product. I would also really, really look at the Dark of Hot Springs Island from Swordfish Islands. If you're looking for something that has that kind of hex crawly feel of you're looking for the items and you need that different environment for it. Pyramid Crawl Classics is really more of an Egyptian-based thesis. And you're looking for things that gods and patrons intervene at every inconvenient turn of the story. Dude, Lankmar, come on. Done.
Yep. Love it. Perfect. So, Julian, we've got another email here that we've done a bit of editing on. Are you ready to dive into this one for us?
Absolutely. Judge to be AIB writes to us, "What ho, dear judges, having discovered DCC RPG during the Kickstarter for the fourth printing, I am loving the system and very eager to start running a game. I started listening to Spellburn earlier this year and breezed through episodes 1 through 66 in 9 weeks.
Oof.
I'm already missing Judges Jim, Job, and Jeffrey, but I'm loving the second generation of judges and, of course, Generation 1.5.
Nice.
I have a treasure chest full of questions, but I'll start with just a few and bombard you with the rest in future emails. Not able to run DCC just yet anyway. Number one, when wizards and elves successfully form a patron bond, do you grant them the patron spells in addition to the spells they otherwise know? Number two, for luck checks, do you have the PCs roll under their luck score or roll with plus their luck modifier to reach a target DC or both? And mm-hmm. if both, why, etc., blah, blah, blah. Number three, if I've heard a great deal in Spellburn about the wonders of Doug Kovacs games, are there any published adventures written by this artist extraordinaire? Well, how timely. Mm-hmm. Finally, I'd like to add that as a straight white CIS male, I fully appreciated your recent episode starting a conversation about inclusivity in gaming without going too long on what I see as one of the biggest challenges in gaming and other geek subcultures. I'd like to say that I especially appreciated Judge Jeff's point about supporting a more diverse array of content creators. Keep up the great podcast, Judge to be AIB. So can I take it first, Jeff?
Absolutely.
All right. Number one, when wizards and elves successfully form a patron bond, do you grant them the patron spells in addition? I believe yes. I think, although the elves automatically get it and it's sort of factored into what they start with. With wizards, I believe that's additional. I don't know. I'd have to look it up otherwise.
Are you talking invoke patron or the spells that wizards can grant their...
Talking about the patron spells themselves.
The patron spell, well, you roll your patron bond and whatever you get is what you get, right? I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
But this person is asking if the patron spells are in addition to the spells that the wizard already knows
yes.
or in place of one of those spells.
Yes, I would say yes. Yes. If you roll a patron bond in, you know, the second adventure you're on, I'm not going to take away a spell you already have and give you a patron spell after you do your patron bond. I'm giving you a new spell.
Yeah,
absolutely. Okay. Number two, for luck checks, do you have PCs roll under their luck score? Always roll
well,
under.
Well, what do you know? We're out of time.
Oh, you're so mean.
What do you know?
So mean.
Always roll under. fake news, fake timers to rigged timers. That timer's been fudged.
All right, Jen, do you have any opinions on any of these things?
Number one, the wizard spells. You know what? Quest for it, or we'll come into it. You don't just get something because you've gained a patron. You got to actually establish some communication, do some stuff for them. You know, they don't give stuff away for nothing. But no, I wouldn't replace a different spell with a patron spell if that's what you're asking. For luck checks, roll under, because the idea is that your luck keeps dropping as you spend it. And if I want you to roll something with a high DC, you get, you know, reflex saves. Number three, Doug Kovacs Games, Hobonomicon is now published.
Great. So you guys did a great job of covering that. The only thing, I completely agree with you guys on the wizard and elf spells. The only thing I would add for the luck checks is that even in printed DCC modules, there are times where it says, have your characters make a DC 15 luck check. So I'm just saying, I am not the only person who is having people roll a D20 and add a luck modifier.
Dude, it's not my fault. There's multiple editors, okay?
That's all I gotta say.
Well, you know, so, when you're wrong, you're wrong.
Moving on next to our next email. Jen, we've got another one from Judge Joan.
Ooh, I get one now. Hi, Judges Jay. Recently, there have been posts on a public Facebook page, not sure if you can advertise on Spellburn, regarding friendly local gaming stores charging players to use their store tables to play RPGs. Now, Goodman Games offers free Rogue Crew swag for DCC and MCC RPG players for running games in public venues, and also X-Krull and Metamorphosis Alpha, that I added that in. I know there are many public venues that one could organize games in. Friendly local gaming stores appear to be the most likely. My question is, what have you, the Judges J, to say about this issue? I've seen some of your comments on the Facebook public page there, but curious to see what you guys have to say. Judge Joan of Arc. You know, it depends on how nice the store people are. If they're saying, you know, maybe take up an offering, you know, maybe $5 an hour, I think, is the highest we've ever paid for a game table. But usually we're really good and we support the store by buying drinks and snacks and dice. And, you know, you always support them in some fashion, because otherwise you're just sitting there taking up space and they're not a library. So that's my take. What about you guys?
Well, I'll go ahead and talk next. I'll say that when I was running the DCC NYC meetup group, we were playing all of our games at the Brooklyn Strategist, and at the Brooklyn Strategist, they do have a cover fee of $10 a person. You cannot play games in the Brooklyn Strategist without paying $10 to get in the doors.
Oof.
And part of that is that it's New York City. And in New York City, there's a $50 tax just for opening up your eyes in the morning. Everything costs something in New York. It's a very expensive place to live. And also, you know, they've got a really expensive rent they need to cover. You know, I'm sure if you've got a gaming store in the suburbs of Birmingham, Alabama, the rent you're paying or the mortgage you're paying on that place is very low. And you've got a lot of real estate where you can put in a bunch of tables and let people game, and you can make your money from selling soda and by selling books. But at a place like the Brooklyn Strategist in New York, they can't. So it depends on where you are. You play where you can. And I'm out of time. Julian, do you have anything you want to add to it?
So important to roll under. That's the main thing. I just want to say, if you know, even if you're a genius like Michael Curtis or somebody, and you said put a high DC on a luck check, you could still maybe be slightly incorrect. I love you, Michael. I like your stuff. Don't get me wrong, but okay. Anyway, it seems absurd to me, but I'm a Midwestern guy, to charge that kind of money. But it is situational. If you have a bunch of asshats showing up and taking advantage of your space, and you're providing all this stuff for free, I can see times where it might make sense to do it. It's very, very situational. You hopefully are not just milking people dry, but on the other hand, game store owners are people too, doing a service to the whole community of gamers, and they can be taken advantage of too. So it's kind of a balancing act. I think it's going to vary place to place and store to store.
Great. Perfect timing. So I've now got an email from Jeff Seifert here. So Jeff, it's good to hear from you. Spellburners, please find below the link to the Swordfish Islands conversion I created. please feel free to include it in episode 64's show notes. Episode 64. That's hilarious. Oops. This is 72.
We're within 10.
So he included the link to the document and he says, thanks and great gaming. Best, Jeff Seifert. Do any of you guys have anything to add to this?
This comes with Jacob's blessing.
Great.
Yes, I will post it both to 64 just for fun and in this episode's notes, because better late than never.
I love it. Okay, Julian, we have an anonymous message.
Ooh. All right. Hello, Spellburners. Do you ever have problems with players who, during a funnel, just pitch a fit because the character they wanted to keep died? I had a game the other day where I had an adult pout so much that he threw a shadow of gloom and sorrow over the entire table and kind of messed up the rest of the game. I talked to this person later outside of the game, and I think it might be solved, but I was just kind of wondering if you have ever encountered something like this, and if so, how did you solve it? You know, we can all have a bad game moment from time to time. I have occasionally lost my temper a little bit here and there as a GM as well. So, you know, I think you have to kind of roll with it. If somebody is having an adverse reaction to losing a funnel character, it's probably just because either they are in a very tough spot emotionally, in which case you want to kind of treat them well and respect that and that kind of stuff. Or, you know, it may just not be the game for them, and in which case they probably, you just play the game out and then let them go their way. That's probably going to be about it, unless I tell you the story about how I threw away a guy's die at Gen Con this year. But
Jen, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yes, I've actually run into this before because I've run funnels at the store for people who are new to this and new to RPGs in general. They're used to, you know, shall we say, MMORPGs. And if they don't like the way something goes, they can just hit a save point and reload. And that is not the case. And they were very, very saddened by the chunk of the dead stamp, which is one of my favorite sounds in the world. And I shrugged and I offered him a new character. I mean, it's completely random. You take what you get thrown and how they end up, you know, it depends on the die and it depends on how you play them too. So it's kind of a learning experience for everybody, I think.
I think that's beautifully said. I think both of you answered this really well. Julian, I really agree with you that it's important to have some empathy for the player and acknowledge where they might be coming from. Jen, I completely agree with you that a lot of the onus is on the judge to make sure that we're making it clear that it's fun to have these zero level characters die, even if it's the one that you were excited about. You know, and I think that kathunk of the stamp can be really jarring, but in a way that actually, I think, oftentimes jolts people out of that kind of depression they get into when they get too attached to that character. And as long as, like, you keep laughing and having a great time, that keeps everybody else laughing and having a great time. I know it's not going to be 100%, but it really does seem to help quite a bit. So, Jen, you've got another Judge Joan email.
Wow, that lady writes a lot. Hey, Judges Jay. The question for you all this time is, what would be so wrong with using the dice chain for spell burning? Let's say this. As the wizard levels up, he or she gains a die along the dice chain. Just as the warrior and dwarf gain a deed die, they would still need to spell burn, as the spell burn die would not gain them much toward the spell. So at level 1, the wizard wouldn't get a spell burn die, but level 2, they would get the D3. Level 3, they'd get a D5, and so on. It might be making the wizard a bit strong, and at some level, there wouldn't be a gaining of a spellburn die. So what would be your take? And I'm not going to answer this one first. You guys take this.
If I'm going to answer it first, I guess I would start by saying that I'm not sure I completely understand this, because I'm not understanding if that means they need to spellburn anything to get this die, or if this die is in place of their modifier or in addition to their modifier. I'm not sure I'm completely following how this house rule works, but I would say that without understanding it, I would say I like the way it works now, and I don't see a big reason to end that, to change that, with the one exception of saying that if we wanted to replace the wizard's flat modifier with the Warriors kind of deed dice style swingy modifier. I think that's fun and flavorful if you want to kind of make more dice involved. And you could also do that with thieves with their thieving skills. I see no reason not to do that, but I'm out of time. Julian.
I would say if you're talking about during casting, that like having a little extra deed modifier to it might be okay, although casting's pretty powerful as is. However, rolling more dice can be more fun. I'm not totally opposed to that. If you're talking, it seems she compares it to sort of a deed die. And the first thing I thought is putting a deed type die on a spellburn roll. It's like in addition to spellburning, when you roll your die, you would add a deed die. Spellburn is already tough enough on us judges without adding any more dice in there. That I would be opposed to. However, I could be interested in things like instead of burning allotted points, you get a die to roll. Or I could be interested in when you burn points, you actually roll on a different die. You can raise your die. That could be interesting with some work.
Interesting.
Okay.
Jen.
So it sounds like Julian's leaning towards one of the house rules of if you spell burn, you get to bump up to, say, a D24 or a D30 to cast. That would actually be easier on my brain than, you know, like Jeff said, there's already so many things. Spellburn's already pretty difficult on us judges. I would actually counter with the Spellburn alternate chart for results where it depends on what your spellcasting result is. And then you look on that chart and that's what you ended up having to do for your Spellburn. Because to me, that just simplifies. And that goes back to the house rule episode.
I like it. So we've got an email here from DM Kojo. Salutations, burners of spells. Running games for kids in my middle school RPG club is never dull. At the beginning of the new adventure, oh, by the way, this is also another edited email.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the new adventure, the wizard decided he wanted to cast Magic Shield before the party entered the main building, and he decided to spell burn a couple of points, and then he rolled a natural 20. So needless to say, that radically altered how the game progressed. One question that arose, though, was how many people can be protected within a 10-foot radius? I ruled that only three other characters other than the wizard could be in the shield bubble. The players thought this was fair, and it has worked out well so far. I'm curious if the judges Jay would have ruled the same way, or if you have suggestions about how to deal with this epic shield problem. Thanks, and keep on burning, DM Kojo. So I'll go ahead and start here and say, I think saying that three other characters can be in the 10-foot shield is fair, considering if you are playing with minis, usually one character takes up a 5-foot square. So in a 10-foot by 10-foot area, that would be four characters, including the wizard, so that'd be three additional. So I think if you want to have three additional characters who are actively fighting and spellcasting and doing things like that, I think that's fair. I think if you've got a bunch of characters who are just kind of huddled together and are trying to stay safe and do nothing other than that, I think you could fit a lot more than just the four of them in there. But they wouldn't be able to do anything except for cower and hide. That's my response. Who wants to go next?
I actually like part of this email from Kojo that got redacted about how he taught the kids, hey, here's a 10-foot radius. Go stand next to each other. There's your visual to go with. And I think that is just invaluable training that a lot of adult RPGers have never had. So I think the kids are a foot up on that one.
That's great. So Julian, do you have any thoughts on this?
So as I was going to say, a radius is 10 feet from the center to the circumference. So it's 20 feet across. And a 20-foot wide circle, you can probably get a fair amount of people. But anyway, definitely more people compressed in a small space to cast the spell and less people when you're actually fighting stuff, right? With big weapons and all that. Mm-hmm. No question about it. I mean, I think the meat of Kojo's question is in what we slightly redacted, which is to mention that this ended up giving everybody a +8 armor class bonus till the next sunrise, which is kind of a pain in the ass if you thought your adventure was going to be sort of a typical adventure today. But on the other hand, it could be pretty funny to see what the characters end up doing to the others and themselves when they have a +8 armor class. So I would say go with it. But I think I just, yes. Anytime players want to actually get up and try to figure out if stuff would work in real life, That's awesome. Please no edged weapons or explosives.
Perfect. So, Julian, we've got another DM Kojo email. You want to take this one?
All right. Hey, guys, I sent a previous suggestion that if you can get Joseph Goodman on to do a What's New show, since he wasn't at GaryCon to do his usual seminar. If you're able to get him on, I had a few questions you could ask. Which DCC modules are almost ready for second printing, and would those new printings include new cover art and bonus content? Number two, are there any big plans for DCC module number 100, which is going to be coming up soon? And number three, what are the plans for Free RPG Day this year? Well, we don't have the Dark Master, and unfortunately, no plans yet, and that takes a fair amount of wrangling and summoning and ritual magic and so on. But we do have something almost as good. It's not really the Dark Master, but I sometimes call her Shadow Lass because, you know, she works in close proximity to the Lord of Darkness.
Shadow Lass.
So, yeah, which, you know, Fred Daly knows what I'm talking about. So, Jen, do you want to? I can say that the second printing of the Black Gate did come out, and it has a bonus adventure by Terry Olson, Crash of the Sky People, right? So, one of those has materialized. It looks pretty cool. I haven't read it yet.
I think for the additional printings, it was the retro covers. I'm trying to remember all of the products on the new table list. Jewels of the Carnifex had a new cover. The One Who Watches From Below has been released. And that has new material insofar as the patron info,
right?
Which is really awesome. Beyond the Black Gate was reprinted. I'm going to miss a couple here. I'm sorry.
Intrigue in the Court of Chaos.
Yeah, that one got reprinted. I know number 97 was out, The Queen of Elfland's Son. And I can answer number two.
Yes.
The big plans for DCC module number 100 is going to be The Music of the Spheres is Chaos. And we're joint answering this one. Get off me. And it's the one that's going to include not two, not three, but four spinners. And if anybody playtested this with me back in 2016, I ran a couple playtests of it at GaryCon and locally and at North Texas. It was actually the reason I went to North Texas. So I've got like 9 playtest groups in there. And it's huge. It's beautiful. It's amazing.
That's awesome.
Oh, number three, plans for Free RPG Day this year. Dude, you missed it. Sorry.
Oops.
We're planning on doing a quick start rules and a short adventure are our plans for this year.
Tune into Sanctum Sacorum for that one.
We did have was a Terry Olson adventure, right? We should plug it at least.
Manbait for the Soul Stealer?
Right. Yes.
Hey, I finally got it right.
There's a character there named Odag.
Odag.
Oh, that's right.
Anagram of Goad.
Oops. Oh, jeez.
Oopsie doodles.
All right.
Anagram, tribute, yeah, whatever.
All right, Jen, we've got... Oh, the timer's going off. Jen, we've got another email here from someone else. You want to go ahead and hit this one? Oh, this is another one that's quite a bit redacted.
Oh, it's not terrible.
Highly confidential, that we had to remove a lot of confidential information.
Yes. This comes from Judge Matthew. Judges, may I approach the bench? Oh, cute. I'm running other games at the moment, but I've been playing and running DCC off and on since the beta, and I enjoy your podcast, as I do for most old school games. I developed a few pages of house rules for DCC, but will reference just a few. I developed 2 campaign-specific profession tables for character creation. I also boiled the 30 birth augur results down to 24, each tied to a rune of the Elder Futhark alphabet. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I give out 1 XP for any fumble roll. I award 1 to 3 luck points per session for various in-game actions, especially heroism. Tumbling thieves. Thieves at my table can burn a point of luck to make themselves immune to a number of attacks incurred by withdrawal from combat. Ooh, and he references page 95 on that. Very nice. Thief senses. All thief characters are entitled to a check to detect any secret door simply by passing within 10 feet of it. That's very old school of you, sir. And he says, I think any judge worth their salt should consider making deity-specific disapproval tables. Okay. Finally, I recommend people look at Chris Hooker's alternate Spellburn actions document. Hey, that's the one I was just talking about.
Yeah.
That's probably more than enough. Keep on hacking and podcasting. Sláinte, Judge Matthew.
Nice.
And yes, Judge Matthew, I don't disagree with much of what you have sent us, except for the luck points per session, because unless you call those temporary luck points, because otherwise you're going to end up with characters with like 30 points of luck and it's just going to be impossible to kill them. So otherwise, yes, Sláinte, next.
Nice. Yeah, I really like a lot of these house rules. I agree with Jen that I think that the 1 to 3 luck points per session might result in a little bit of bloat, but I think it's going to depend on how your characters are spending luck. If they are spending that luck left and right, then certainly I think reward them luck back. But I also think it's important to keep luck as kind of a low commodity, especially for those roll the body rolls. It's nice to have it kind of be something that is intense and dramatic when it comes up. But I think a lot of these other house rules are very clever. As for judges making their own deity-specific disapproval table, I will say I agreed with you. I have since changed my opinion about this, only in that I'm really into what Brendan LaSalle is doing right now and how he just kind of like makes it up on the spot. And I feel like any judge worth their salt will be making up their own disapproval results on the spot based on what's happening in the story. Julian.
Yes, and which is also customized to the deity. So yeah, absolutely, 100% agree. Did you get to play in one Brendan's game like that at Gen Con?
Not at Gen Con. I did a as a housewarming gift to me moving to Cleveland, he put on a game for me and a bunch of people who I invited to join.
Oh, nice. Nice.
It was really fun.
That's super interesting when he is running that way. Like, I was in his Origins game like that, and it was like, whoa. Anyway, we already talked about that. I don't have a lot to add because these are all pretty cool ideas, and we've already been over them. 1 to 3 luck points, you know, my pal Doug Kovacs always says that people don't give enough luck, which is probably true. 1 to 3 per, I mean, it could bloat, so it's hard to say until you see it in action. But generally, given luck is good, and hopefully encouraging people to spend it is good. I'm out. You guys, I think these are all pretty cool, and they all make sense to me.
All right, great. So we've got another email here from a Mr. DM Mark Maloney. Hey, Spellburners. I was totally wound up when I heard my email read and the possibility of a podcast on house rules. I felt like the bald warded wizard bound to Bubugbabills as he sweats through a dark tome of pleasures to appease his patron. We have another house rule that I incorporated after reading the fine RPG called Torchbearer. Short story, I get bored dungeon crawling when I feel that the team are dragging their feet or spending too much time in a particular spot, and I add conditions to keep them moving. For example, this is the third session of a small 20-room dungeon, and I'm getting bored, and I notice some of the players are starting to handle their phones too much. Time for a condition to get them thinking and moving. I start with thirsty and hungry, -1 to all rolls, and then I let them know that their food and drink has been all used up. I make certain there is nothing around for them to eat or drink. Still, slowly, after an hour of play, now you are exhausted, -2 to all rolls. Last would be sick, -3 to all rolls. I have only had to use this twice with my current group. One third level died when she was exhausted one time. The next time when they were diddling around, I pseudo-rolled my D12 a few times, acting like I was checking something in my book, and then I told them they were thirsty and hungry. Lit a fire under their murder hobo butts, and within an hour, they had what they needed and got out of there. Love the podcast, love the hosts, all the way back to the beginning, and I can't say enough about the fantastic G+ community support. What a great place to gather info, provide opinions, and...
Palaver?
I don't know that word. Palaver. Yes, let's palaver. So get down with your bad selves. DM Mark Maloney. So thank you, Mark. I'll start in first. I have my own trick with that. I've got my sand timers. When I toss the 1 minute sand timer out, when they're starting to kind of drag their butts, things get moving because they know when that 1 minute sand timer runs out, something of consequence is going to happen. And maybe I don't even know what that something of consequence is when I set that sand timer down, but I also have a minute to figure that out.
Nice.
And I prefer things like that to keep the story moving rather than more modifiers and more things to keep track of in terms of like, I don't know, numbers. That's a little bit more of a slog for me personally, but that's my take on that.
I'll jump in and say, I'm not a big fan of conditions generally because, aside from not liking all the math necessarily, I just won't remember to apply it consistently or enforce it. I don't really have too much trouble because I can't remember if it was Dungeon World or one of those books, but sometime in the last 4 or 5 years, they really emphasize just going back to your players a lot and saying, okay, what would you like to do next? What would you like to do next? Okay, awesome. So he's dead. What would you like to do next? Nope, there's nothing in that chest. What would you? And you know what? That really tends to drive things forward. I'm pretty energetic and I like to keep people moving. I just don't have too much problem with it. But rolling behind the screen sometimes gets people's attention, and wandering monsters are good for that, or screams in the next room, timers going off, that kind of thing.
Jen.
I like to refer to my clipboard a lot and make a lot of, mm-hmm. And that makes them go, oh, crap. And I also try to institute a no devices at the table rule, which keeps everybody just, come on, let's go. Like, you know, if I have to re-explain the situation every time it comes around to your turn, this is slowing the game down, do it again, I'm going to dock you luck. Mm. -1 luck. And palaver, prolonged and idle discussion.
Oh, thank you, Jen.
P-A-L-A-V-E-R.
Palaver.
Dr. Goad sometimes says that clerics are not a worthwhile class, but Dr. Burnick considers that palaver.
Judge Jen says it's too hot for palavering. Yes.
That's great. All right. So we've got another email here ready for you, Julian.
Hey, Spellburners, from Judge David Northcutt. I've just spent the past 6 months listening to every Spellburn episode. I've loved them all and find them a great source of inspiration. Can't wait for the next one. Now that I've made it through the 68-episode funnel, I've got a question for you. but hopefully intact and safe and sound. When is it okay for the judge to take away a player's control of their PC? I think some would say never, and some would say sometimes under the right circumstances. I'm having a bit of trouble deciding where the line is. I'm thinking specifically about a couple of encounters in Sailors on the Starless Sea. Trying to avoid spoilers, there are 2 points in that adventure where unsuspecting PCs may investigate an area that causes them to make a will save, and if they fail, their PC does something the player really doesn't want to do. Spoiler, 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 spoiler. I'm talking about looking in the Well of Souls and trying to trace spirals on the Menhir near the Starless Sea in the second underground level, blah, blah, blah. Okay, yep. When you're running a funnel, it kind of takes the sting out of these kinds of situations for the player since they're running more than one PC. But I'm wondering about where you guys think the line is for something like this in general. Am I worried about nothing? Any advice would be welcome. Jeff, what do you think?
I think that as long as they are failing a will save and or doing something obviously stupid, because if you pick up this object that clearly, you know, is sitting in the demon statue's hands and looks like it's got some kind of demonic runes on it, there's a chance that when you pick that thing up, something bad is going to happen. So as long as those kinds of things are happening, I think the social contract of the game is that it's fair game and your character might be taken over and might do something that they did not intend to do. It's very much a part of the literature that inspires this, especially Fafhrd and Grey Mouser. They are often having their wills taken from them and they're going forth on quests that they were not seeking out, or they are somehow doing something that is not in their nature. And I think the same bit of advice that we gave for the characters who are upset about their zero level characters dying is, as long as you are laughing about it, having fun with it, and making it clear that this is a part of the game that we're all playing, then I think it is all good fun. Jen, what do you think?
Yeah, there's a limit to the amount of agency that the judge can actually take with a player. But then there are some adventures, Tower of the Black Pearl, where just touching a certain item, you're automatically making a role, or that player is, to bond themselves to a patron, whether or not they want to. And so I'm kind of thinking that, especially in a funnel situation, yeah, it shouldn't be a big deal, as the player should be able to roll with it since they do have multiple characters in front of them. If it is your one and only character, you know, stuff happens. It's no different than Charm Person or Paralyzation, which just completely renders you inactive. So stuff happens to your characters. You don't always like it.
Julian, do you want to take a minute for this?
Not a whole minute, but I will say I prefer to just give the player the role. If it's a new personality that's going to come into the player, I would like to have them be the, you know, the player take on that role within his PC, because that keeps the player in the game. And, you know, I think that really increases the fun and gives the player a challenge of doing something with a little coaching. It's not always easy because not every player is prepared for that, but still kind of the most fun way to go if you can pull it off. And it's good to challenge people to try something different.
I think that is a great suggestion. And I'm really impressed with how far we've gotten through our mailbag. It would be really amazing to say that we had made it through them all. We haven't quite yet. It appears there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's still 5 more in the mailbag, but that will give us emails to respond to in our next few episodes. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap things up with that. Guys, thank you so much for helping us get through this big ol' mailbag speedball episode.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, we actually have cleaned out a huge pile of mail here, so it's time to send us some more. And we will, I think we have to keep the timer going so we actually get through more on every episode going forward.
Yeah, I think the timer is a good idea. Maybe it doesn't need to be a minute. Maybe it'll be 2 minutes or something. We'll figure it out.
Yep.
But I think the timer is going to keep us nice and tight on these.
Absolutely. So send us some more. Refresh us. Time to recharge.
But it's funny, though. The gamist in me is already like, oh, if you do the Judge Joan approach and you send several short emails, then you get more time than if you send one long email. I'm already like gaming the system in my head,
too.
If you start submitting emails, we're going to have words. We're going to have palavers.
I have thought about like doing some sock puppet emails just to mess with you guys, but no.
Thank you.
That's hilarious. So yes, if you would like to send us an email, please do so at theband@spellburn.com. You can also leave us a review on iTunes. If you rate us, subscribe, and review, that helps make the podcast more visible to others who might end up finding it. And thanks again to Hector Cruz, our awesome editor. You are keeping this show tight and afloat. So thank you. Everyone, thank you guys for joining. And yeah, keep on rocking.
Oh, one last thing. Congratulations to our last guest, John Hook, for winning a podcast Annie at Gen Con.
Good point.
Yes.
John Hook.
And he got the gold.
Yes.
Yes.
That was pretty cool.
Golden Annie. Wow.
And I'm pretty sure even though our episode came out late, we somehow kind of pushed him over the top with our podcast karma or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We can say that we knew him before. We knew him back when.
So congrats, John. That's excellent. Keep up the good work. And enough said.
And thanks again to everyone who's written in and kept the show afloat up to this point. We do appreciate you, our listeners.
Thank you very much, and game on.
You've been listening to Spellburn. Copyright 2017. The theme song has been graciously provided by Glitter Wizard. Learn more at glitterwizard.bandcamp.com.
This has been a Hectophonic production.